My first question, Mr. Gaps, and thank you very much for your time, is what are you Yaringinda? Who are you?
So I'm Stephen Gaps. I'm an historian, but I guess I've been focusing on what people call frontier wars history. I kind of don't like the term frontier wars so much these days. I actually think the Australian Wars is a better way of thinking about it, describing it, because like the frontier is the edge of the colony going out. It's not a shared understanding. I know an uncle I speak to, Uncle Bill, he says he prefers something like a war for the defence of homelands, right?
Yeah.
Rather than looking from the centre of the colony to the edge, you know? It was invented by historians, you know, 50 years ago to try to describe that big conflict, but you know, no one's asked Aboriginal people what they want to call the wars, right? So I've worked with Rachel Perkins on the Australian Wars documentary series, which was really great. And we're working on a book of that now, the Australian Wars.
Yeah.
And I think she's nailed it by calling it the Australian Wars, because Australians need to own up to those wars just as much as they need to, you know, commemorate other wars, in my mind.
Mm.
So that's what I've been working on the last 10, 15 years, is Australian Wars histories.
Yeah. Deadly, Dadaway Woomba, Dadanan, that's mad. And I've been doing a bit of, you know, background research on you, and I've been fortunate to be reading some of your books recently too as well. But you're saying you're a fellow Westie.
Yeah.
And you grew up in Western Sydney, correct?
Yeah.
And so what was that like? And do you think that had any... How did you get into history? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting, because Western Sydney, when I grew up, was pretty... Yeah, it wasn't that great, you know?
Yo.
It was... But... as a young kid, I was like, why do I... I lived in Blacktown. And the first thing I thought when I became a teenager was, why is it called Blacktown, right? And so I did a bit of research, and it's like, it used to be called the Blacks Town, right? And I'm like, God, everyone who lived in Blacktown doesn't even know that, you know? And then I went, hang on, why do I live on a street called Bungarabee Road, right?
Mm.
What does that mean?
Mm.
And I'm like, that must be an Aboriginal word. And then so I investigated that. That was actually one of the critical things that got me interested in history, was the fact that there's all this stuff around us in Western Sydney, in my place, that we don't know about. And they're important. When you start looking into those histories, I was like, the Sydney Wars, the book that came out in 2018, I was thinking about that 30 years ago, in a way, you know, that was a story that was happening right across Sydney. And there's all these historians who focused on early colonial Sydney in the city, you know?
Mm.
The story of Western Sydney wasn't told. And that was a story of Pemulwuy. That was a story of other warriors and the battles that were fought. Battle at Parramatta, you know? That got me started on history.
The West is the best.
And the Western Sydney Wanderers, don't forget them.
That's it. That's right. All day. And so, that leads me into my next question, Gawa, is, what do you think, before their mob came over here, what were they sort of thinking? What was their sort of rationale? Obviously, Cook had some yarns and he wrote some stuff in 1770 that was related back to them fellas. But what was the sentiment before these fellas rocked up here?
Yeah, that's a good point, because they didn't know that much. They knew a bit from Cook and Banks, but they didn't really stop. And they stopped in Queensland for a while, and 8 days at Camay, Botany Bay, right?
Yep.
So they didn't know that much. But I guess one of the things that I looked at was that the First Fleet, I hate calling it the First Fleet, Governor Phillips' fleet, the 1788 fleet, they were really prepared. And a lot of people, a lot of historians said, but they didn't bring enough musket balls. Actually, no, they were prepared. They had enough for a year. But they thought they were going to get resupplied from South Africa and round. And there was going to be a second fleet, but the ships got sank, and so they were a bit, So That's why they ran out of musket balls. They didn't run out, but that's why it was low. It wasn't because they were underprepared.
Yeah.
They knew that they would have a constant supply chain coming into Sydney, you know, after they landed. So they also, preparation, you know, they brought in food, they brought in convicts, they brought in cattle, sheep, horses. They brought in vials of smallpox as well. And, like, it had been used in North America.
Mm-hmm.
It was on board the ship as a treatment, potentially.
Mm-hmm.
But they knew that it could cause havoc amongst indigenous populations. Mm. They knew because it occurred in the United States, right?
Yeah.
So that's, you know, you've got to think of that as one of their preparations. Whether it was then set out the year after they arrived intentionally or not, it's hard to say from historical evidence.
Yeah.
But it looks, you know, it looks like it. Particularly, there's a guy, Major Ross, who's with the First Fleet. He wanted the fleet. He wanted them to go home. He was like, "What are we doing here? This is a waste of time. Let's go." Because he was because the Sydney people were rising up, and was conflict was increasing. They were guarding convicts. It was like, no. I think potentially to get rid of one problem was to release the smallpox. You know, and a lot of people agree because it's just too. It was too. You know, there's no smoking gun, but the circumstantial evidence is there.
The Wadamudigal, like, you know, in the first 2 weeks of contact from, you know, what I've read too, about, like, it's all there, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, no, deadly goa. Therefore, could you describe, like, what the early colony was like then? Just, you know, you've equated it in your writings to be, like, it was known even years after that into the 1840s as the camp or the, you know... But so therefore that infers a very heavy militaristic sort of sentiment. There's obviously a lot of, you know, as you're saying, the muskets and that, they were firing ceremonial rounds like left, right and centre, like just even cannons and that were displayed as well. Yeah. But yeah, describe what do you think was some of the, what was the early colony like here?
Look, I think a lot of historians have tended to focus on the fact that there wasn't that much conflict initially in the 70s, you know, in the first 10 years, say. And therefore they've said, oh, you know, there was it was a peaceful settlement, right? In fact, what I found was that when they arrived in January 1788, the Sydney people are interested, like, keen. And they saw Cook before. And he came, he stayed, he looked around and he went, you know. Then these guys stay, right? And then the fish supply starts going down, right? So then in that first 12 months, conflict does start to increase. You know, at first there was curiosity. What are these guys doing? What do they wear? What goods have they got, you know? Then slowly but surely, it only takes 12 months, conflict increases. So that Philip says that the only people who can go outside the encampment have to have arms with them. You can't just wander out, right? There was that much conflict going on. Then what happens? Smallpox breaks out, right? So, you know, and we're talking at least 50% of the population around Sydney in the Sydney Basin killed within a few days, weeks, right? Maybe 80%, right? So just think about what might have happened if smallpox hadn't been released then. That conflict was escalating. The colony was on the edge of starvation. The storeships hadn't come. It was a pretty shitty place. But... you know, you could say smallpox saved the day for those colonists.
That's very harrowing stuff. That leads me. What in your findings, though, like the local mob around here, what were some of the key characteristics of their resistance, though?
Look, I find it quite incredible that, you know, just a few years later, after 50-80% of your people have been killed, like that's half your warrior force, right? At least, that they start to resist again. Now, you know, some people go, obviously, people like Bennelong and that, they go, right, survival mode, right?
Yeah.
We have to interact with these people. They're here to stay. They've told me they're staying. They're not going anywhere. But there's people like Pemulwuy who just go outside the colony and stay outside the colony. And Pemulwuy leads a guerrilla warfare campaign for the next 10 years, you know? So, yeah, like, I find it amazing that resistance after smallpox can go on, you know?
Did he instill such a sentiment of fear amongst the early colony, like, that potentially they were on the brink of collapse? Yeah. Could you attribute that to his insurgency?
Yeah, there was a great fear of Pemulwuy leading all the so there was a particular fear of uniting, like, just Darragon, Gara, Dharawal. Yeah. Like, and if they united, that would have been terrible for the colonists. They were vastly outnumbered by all those warriors together, right? So that was a particular fear. They kind of could manage to guard Parramatta. I mean, Parramatta itself, the first building in Parramatta was a fort.
Yeah.
The first structure in Sydney was a little stockade, you know, to put cannon behind, right? So this whole military presence is very carefully controlled at first. Mm. So it's really difficult for warriors to attack. And Pemulwuy attacks Parramatta, leads an attack in Parramatta, and of course is defeated, right? But, you know, that's by the time they've got a level of military infrastructure in the colony.
Mm.
But when they want to expand the colony, and they're getting out towards the southern districts, towards the mountains, that's terrain where warriors have got the key. And they constantly write about how we can't defeat these guys because they attack and they disappear into the mountains or they cross the river. You know, they've got this terrain advantage, you know.
Yeah.
And so that guerrilla warfare campaign, and it's killing sheep and cattle, the precious, expensive items of the colonists, or burning the wheat fields, right?
Yeah.
So that's a real threat. And that's why Pemulwuy's the governor puts a bounty on his head. He needs to stop that, you know?
Mm-hmm. What were some of the tactics that Pemulwuy was using, like, obviously, besides guerrilla tactics as well?
Yeah, well, hit-and-run tactics.
Yep, yep.
Another one we don't think about, I don't think it was really Pemulwuy, this was up on the Darabin Hawkesbury River, was raids by canoe and raids at night as well. Because everyone says, oh, warriors didn't really raid at night. Yes, they did when they had to, right? And they attacked ships, like actual boats on the Hawkesbury River, right? Like, you know, there's some incredible moments. And then, you know, you think about the battle at Razorback where a scratch force, right, of convicts, armed convicts, a couple of soldiers and settlers, right, with guns, are defeated, routed by warriors who take a position in rocks, right? They use this rocky terrain and they throw stones down on them. And then when they shoot, they jump behind the rocks and jump up again and throw spears at them, right? And that tactic is really, really good. They defeat that force and they're routed. And that's when Governor Macquarie steps in and says, we can't have this. We've got to clear all that resistance from around Sydney.
True,
and that's when that campaign happens and the Appin massacre comes about.
Deadly. How quickly did the local mob adopt the use of muskets as well?
Yeah. Surprising. But like in the 1790s, it was known that stands of firearms, muskets, were being taken by Aboriginal people. They weren't used that much. There was one case I know of out at on the Hawkesbury Nepean River where a bunch of warriors surrounded these five white guys who were chasing them with firearms, right, ambushed them and said, drop your firearms. Then they picked up their guns and shot them, right? So, you know, they did use firearms. The problem with using firearms is you've got to resupply them. So later on in frontier wars elsewhere, they were used much more often because there was more supply available, right? And you could go into the settlements and get, you know, powder and shot and whatever. Around Sydney, not so much, but it was known,
Deadly. And I know a lot of our yarns have just been centric around Sydney, but, you know, offering a lot of respect and honour to the frontier wars, I mean, the resistance everywhere, you know, not just people like Yagan, Dunderley and Yandamara, but also the ones we don't know about, which are numerous, you know. When I was having a yarn with an old uncle of mine, like, our history of first contact, where we're from up on the coast, he equates that, you know, 9 out of 10 fellas were already put dead by smallpox by the time of first contact around the 1820s, you know, we're up from up the coast. But what were some of the clear indications of suppression or censorship around this history you found in your research, if I may, in some of the sources you investigated? I know that's a loaded question, but was there any?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the early governors, they've got a mission to set up this colony, right? And if it's in trouble and they're getting their forces defeated by warriors, they don't want to write home about it too much, right? Because it doesn't look so good, right? So So that happens. Like they downplay the resistance because you got the governor's reports, and then you look at like a colonist who's written, "We're constantly at war with the natives," you know, and meanwhile the governor's saying, "Oh, there's been some slight skirmishes, you know, nothing to worry about here, nothing to see here, right?" But the settlers themselves who are on the ground are going, "We're always at war. There's this constant sort of war going on right through Sydney, right through that time period." So there is a kind of suppression of it by the authorities at one level. When you get to a point where later on the settlers, it's a silly term.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't settle anything. Mm-hmm. The colonists, when they start conducting their own campaigns, when there's not enough military around, that's where they start to cover things up. But also I think I blame historians as well, recent historians, like and that's one of the things that got me into all this was there's been so much written about early colonial Sydney, so many history books, right, and none of them have talked about it as being war or there was a guerrilla war. It's just about building the early colony, whatever. And it's been missed. And you get this idea, you read any of those general history books until recently, and you think it was kind of peaceful, right? But when you actually drill down and focus on all the conflict that was going on, put it together, it wasn't peaceful. There was resistance going on. Yeah, there were people engaging with the colony, but there was also resistance. And it's tended to have been kind of brushed out in recent history writing, and that's why there's a lot of historians like me now trying to rewrite those histories. And there's so much work to be done because there are so many other stories like that. Like Sydney's just one, and that's why I went on to Bathurst, and then I went elsewhere, right? So many places around this country where those local stories of resistance still need to be told.
Long time overdue. Like, really appreciate the work you've been doing. You know, it wasn't for also Comrade Paddy for introducing us to your work too, particularly when I was out on that country as well. Obviously familiar with Aunty Mary Coe's work before, about hearing about Windradyne growing up, but really, really top notch stuff you've been doing, though, you know. But that sort of reminds me too, like, would it be a fair assumption, or not a fair statement to state that when Governor Macquarie declared martial law and shoot on sight, basically 1802, 1811.
Macquarie was 1816. His campaign.
Yep.
Was it? Brisbane was 1820s for Western. That was 1824. He declared martial law. Macquarie didn't actually declare martial law, but he said he had a massive military campaign in 1816.
Would you equate therefore?
But he gave orders to shoot on sight, etc.
And instill that's the quote. Instill fear in the natives. But would you therefore equate, like, the colony actually was in a state of total war in terms of from an economy standpoint, like their whole, would that be a true statement?
Yeah,
to state?
The economy was threatened. Definitely. Like, one thing that led me to look at Bathurst was because in 1816 Macquarie sends out these regiments, like detachments, skirmishing all around from Windsor, Richmond, you know those places.
Down
through Penrith and Nepean, right down to the south around Appin, Campbelltown, right? So he sends them out. He also then goes, and sends a detachment to guard the road across the Blue Mountains to Bathurst, right? Because he knows there's this state of warfare going on, and if that road is cut, the Bathurst Plains, which he's worked out is going to be the economic powerhouse of the country, right, the colony, they'll lose it because there's only like 100 white guys out there, right? In a Wiradjuri nation of maybe 10,000 people, right? So he sends his detachment out there, and I found that really important, that it was a military decision to guard the Bathurst area because it was a critical economic part of the colony, right? The military and economy, go hand in hand, right?
Yeah, of course, The military, like a colonial military industrial complex, like the one we're in right now. Could you talk a bit about the Wiradjuri uprising, if possible, or the Wiradjuri resistance out there, since we're out there, sort of canonically? You know, my understanding, Pemulwuy and Tedbury kept them at bay at Parramatta till Tedbury was killed, like 1812, I suspect, and then they were able, obviously we were skirmishing, to get out there to Bathurst. But when did the Bathurst Wars really?
So Macquarie goes, they set up a little small township in Bathurst in 1815. It's a military garrison to start with, because it has to be, right? But there's, like in Sydney, at first, there's no conflict. Like, the Wiradjuri fellas are probably curious with, about these white guys, and there's only 100 of them. And it's only a pinprick in the vast Wiradjuri nation, right? So it's easily managed, right? And it still stays that way because Macquarie didn't want to, do this massive land rush because it was difficult to control the convicts, et cetera, et cetera. It's probably right. So for several years, up until he gets the boot in 1820,
yep.
It's only a small township, Bathurst. But then Governor Brisman comes in. He's been told, you've got to expand the colony. So he opens up the Western Plains, right? And from 1822, conflict starts to grow. And in 1824, it's total war. What happens in 1824 is that the settlers' right reports that all the Wiradjuri people who used to come in and out and talk to us, they've all gone, right? They've left. And that's when Windradyne's night attacks and skirmishes occur, and Blucher's raids, and Simon and Jingler in the south, right around in this big circle around Bathurst, right through the central west, all these attacks occur around in 1824. 20 colonists are dead. A cart with 7 white bodies on it rolls through the main street of Bathurst. That's when the governor says, right, I'm declaring martial law, because he sees that area as part of the colony of New South Wales, right?
Mm.
They've declared possession, it's crown land in his mind, right? So he doesn't want to, he can't, in his mind, declare war against a foreign nation because he already says it's his, right?
Mm.
So, but the next best thing is martial law. So declaration of martial law, and that is if you have a rebellion, like in Ireland rebels against, UK.
Benninger Hill, yeah.
So, in effect, any rebellion can be treated as the same way as a war. So it can be put down and fought the same way as the Brits would fight a war. So whether it was martial law or declaring war, it's the same
thing. Same shit, yeah. Clear slather, open slather, shoot on sight. And that, yeah, not following end. And that led to the establishment of the Mounted New South Wales Police, eh?
Yeah, totally. The colonists have been calling out for, especially in the Bathurst Plains, because you've got this flat country, different around Sydney so much.
Mm-hmm.
You've got this big flat country, and the only way you can get up close to warriors, right, is on a horseback.
Yeah.
Right? Otherwise, they're gone, right? So they know that horses are the key, right? And a couple of guys with horses and guns can pretty much rule the roost, right?
Yeah.
So they've been calling out for this what they firstly called a colonial cavalry force, right? Then they come up with this idea, we'll call it Mounted
like
Police.
Like no.
Yeah, like that.
You.
And then they say, right, let's form the Mounted Police. So just after the Bathurst War, they learn, we've got to have a mounted force. And they call it a police force, right? But it really, in essence, it's doing a lot of military functions as well on the frontier.
Obviously familiar a lot later with some of the work David Marr's been doing, like in relation to the native police that happens.
Yeah.
Obviously that's a lot later down the track chronologically, and obviously more illustrations of that sort of like censorship that's being done by those direct colonists. It's funny, like a lot of our old people still have, it's almost like this collective instillment of fear towards horses still to this day. Like a lot of my old people were like, some of them even fought in the First World War in the fucking Light Horse Brigade, but fucking hated horses. So it's clear to see there's still that sort of, we call them Yatterman. It's pretty collectively, that's the sound they make, But my next question is about monuments. And it's funny, we're talking about Bathurst, we're going to monuments now. And obviously that's a sort of relevant and contentious issue of late. I quote Khalid Muhammad. He says, "America awards her killers with stars and stripes and bars." And ribbons as well, sorry. Would you equate, do you think there's a parallel here in Australia too, with the way that certain people are, exonerated here?
Mm.
In a lot of our architecture and even in the place names, as you're saying too. Obviously, I think I'm aware most of our monuments, firstly, are First World War, and then second, are generally pertaining to this era. Would you say there's a parallel there?
Yeah. But I think we have this incredible emphasis on Anzac monuments and the Anzac, anything related to Anzac, right?
The base.
Right? And so, and that is one element, but we also have all those colonial statues.
Yeah.
Right? And colonial names and whatever. And, in a lot of my work, I come across these well-known names
yep.
of colonists.
Yep.
And I go, oh, hang on, he was connected to that massacre that occurred, blah, 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 right? And you just go, I totally understand why, you know, some monuments are traumatic, divisive, and probably should be changed, right? At least reinterpreted, you know, at least, if not, you know, changed. So I think, yeah, I think we've got a lot of work to do in that area. A lot of people say to me too, but what do we want? Do we want to have lots of, we want to have equal monuments to the Australian Wars, right?
Mm.
And I'm not sure, because I think that's a question for First Nations people, because I don't think people want to replicate colonial monuments or Anzac monuments.
Mm.
I think it's like if you look at the Mile Creek commemoration, have you been to that site?
No, but a near auntie of mine's on the board
there. It's the most amazing commemorative site, and it's not about just a figure on a statue, right? It's about the landscape. You have to walk through it. There's interpretation. It's a really moving place, right? And I think those sorts of things are where we should be looking at a different way of making monuments, but we do need to address particularly those colonial ones.
I was going to sort of steer away from the how question of how Australia deals with its sort of, you know, as some people sort of call it, the sort of national psychosis or national amnesia of sorts, because, you know, like Germany with reconciling its sort of, you know, its history of industrial genocide, likewise here, it is such a massive cultural issue that I you know, I think I'm familiar with the history wars of, you know, when people like Windschuttle and Reynolds were going at it, and obviously, you know, one could equate history is always going to be inevitably tied to, at least a mainstream history is always going to be inevitably tied to some extension of colonial power or the hegemony of the current day, and you know, we're dealing with that, and obviously, like with this. With the real history surfacing, this is sort of something that's going to be, you know, dealt with. But yeah, I don't know how. It's such a heavy and traumatic thing, particularly for our community, particularly with the infrastructure of our community, of how do we eulogize these things in a sacred and respectful way. You know, my last question though, on a positive note though, not denoting that, is what would you say to any young aspiring young Guri who wants to research their own resistance history, like locally wherever they are, if they're out Cowra, if they're out up north, if they're ever wherever going, you know, what would you sort of say to them?
Well, I would say go for it. Like it's really important that it's not just white fellas like me doing this history for a start. I think it's really important too that people like, I try to go and talk to community and bring, you know, First Nations knowledge alongside archival evidence, bring the two together, right? But we need you know, First Nations historians to do that as well, and to do that in a much, much better way than can be done. And we need to do it locally, because a lot of, you know, people like Gary Foley, Marsha Langton, you know, John Maynard, they have told the bigger picture. Stories. Rachel Perkins told the bigger picture. We need those local stories to be done, and they are so important, and we need people with access and knowledge. And also I encourage history, the study of history, because it needs a shake up as well.
It needs
people who can deal with oral history and archival history, because I think those two things are so critical in this space.
Are you seeing a sort of shift within the academy around the acceptance of our oral histories as a credible source?
Yeah,
I know it was noting Windschuttle, that was a common thing he would often use to, you know, to delegitimize a lot of yarns. But is that sort of changing, you're saying?
Yeah. It is changing. But, you know, the history wars aren't over.
No.
Like,
they're just beginning,
maybe they settled down a bit, you know. And there's people trying to like resuscitate Windschuttle, you know. So, and they are the sort of people saying, no, history is objective. History is in the written record. Like, I look at written records and it's total fucking bullshit. Stop, excuse the
French. All good, all good.
Total, you know, that lies, right? And I go, well, hang on, you've got, you can't say that only written record is the truth, you know? So, yeah, I think, it's got a long way to go. Mm. There are positive signs. There's people like me, other historians doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the communities I talk at, I was asked the other day at Bathurst, you know, do you find oral history, like, is it different to the written history? And I say, most of the time, they say the same thing. They back each other up.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay.
No, that's relieving to hear. Because I just find it's just so fucking preposterous for me to say so. The only country on earth that can't fucking deal with its own fucking fucked up genocidal history is this Jesus that we're fucking dealing with here. Mm. And it's like, it's so indentured within the fabric and literally of every fucking street sign, every place name is all some symbology of reiterating that sort of discourse or power structure or narrative, you know? So, yeah, that's why what we can do is, as young people, is just instill that with our young people, you know, and try and generate that sort of collective consciousness. It's just sort of.
Don't be afraid of historians. I know there's a real fear about historical records, you know, because that was used as a form of violence to Aboriginal people in the past. Yeah. It was, you know, and I can understand that fear. That distaste.
Or even trying to access them.
Exactly. I can understand that. But there is a wealth of information that can do with that cultural lens from the other side.
Yeah.
Like, it's there. I really encourage it. Really encourage it.
Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Gap.
Thank you.
All right. That was a mad yarn.